Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is a man who is calling himself Max Coins. I think you'll find him very knowledgeable and interesting about a number of gambling topics. Gambling with an Edge is entering a new phase starting today. We taped our last show a week ago on Tuesday, March 29th. On Wednesday, March 30th, we received an email from the radio station that they were going out of business for unnamed reasons, effective that very day. So, what to do? Neither Richard nor I were ready to retire from the co-hosting business. It's very easy to find another radio station to host our program in Las Vegas if we didn't mind how much we paid for the privilege of working with them. We've come up with what we think are our two best alternatives, and we're going to be trying both of them over the next several weeks. So right now, there's no way to listen live, but a high percentage of our listeners get us through various forms of podcasts, so that shouldn't change anything. The audio quality might be a little bit worse going forward, but it should still be acceptable. After all, it's not like we were singing or playing an instrument, where extremely high audio quality is important. Trust me, a musical duet featuring Richard and me is something up with which you do not wish to put. A few weeks ago, we mentioned a bet between poker players whether a particular player named Dan Bilzerian could bicycle 300 miles between Los Angeles and Las Vegas in less than 48 hours. Well, he did, sort of, and is said to have earned between $600,000 and $1.2 million for the feat, depending on which article you read. Many other poker players had side bets one way or the other as to whether he could accomplish this. There's some controversy about it. He hired a police escort part of the way, and for part of the way rode immediately behind a van with its back doors open to block the wind. One of the pictures I saw had him riding maybe 5 feet behind the van, which doesn't sound too safe to me, but it's unclear how this is going to be arbitrated. Apparently, he won the main bet, but other players may decide on arbitration. Richard, Max, did you have a bet for or against Dan?
I was surprised, actually, at how quickly he was able to do it. But, you know, he is in good physical shape, apparently, and did a lot of training. I'm also surprised that this is a common technique. It's called drafting. And so like in the Tour de France or these big bike races, there are guys whose job it is to, like Lance Armstrong had guys who would ride in front of him to, you know, I was going to say to break wind, but actually they are cutting down on the wind resistance by being in front of him. So it just surprised me that the people making the bet didn't take this idea into consideration and discuss it ahead of time. Because, yeah, he had a van in front of him with the doors open wide, and there was some kind of a, you know, like a moonroof popped up on the top as well to cut a lot of the wind. But I read an interview with the guy who lost the bet, and he said that he did stop the drafting at some point when he had complained about it, and that he would have won the bet even without the drafting. So, you know, I don't think it turned out to be an issue, but it's certainly something they should have thought about ahead of time. But the other thing I read was that he almost died a couple of times. I mean, he was riding in the dark and exhausted, and when cars would speed by, they would sort of suck him out into the lane, and you know, sounded really dangerous. But hey, hats off to him. He completed it. He won the money. They also said he spent over $100,000 on everything that was involved in the bet.
Well, it's probably a good investment. I mean, it's I can't imagine doing something like that. I don't even like to drive that far. Let alone, you know, well, I mean, I guess as far as the drafting thing is concerned, I mean, that just emphasizes how important it is to kind of define the terms of what you're doing before you actually go ahead and do it. But, you know, a lot of times poker players certainly are known for this. I mean, I recall a bet, I think it was Huck Seed who had a bet that he could stand in the ocean for 24 hours or something, waist level. I don't think he made it very far into that one, but it's funny what people will do for... to win a prop bet.
Yeah, Huck Seed also had a bet, I think, where he had to stay inside a strip club for 24 hours. And I don't know if he was able to complete that one or not. But.
Well, there was another guy who had to stay in a bathroom for a month. I would think that would be a little harder.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We actually might get that man on the air. We're in negotiations.
I'm working on it. He's the last I talked to him. He said, yeah, I'm going to do your show. I don't know when, but he'll come on.
All right. The voice you've been hearing, in addition to Richard, is Max Coins. He works in the options business. For several years, was an option trader. He's highly skilled in mathematics, and today he's going to apply some of those mathematical skills to interesting gambling problems. Max Coins, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you.
Now, several of your – you sent us a list with some things to talk about, and several of them relate to video poker. So we're going to start with those. For some reason, I find those most interesting. I hope I get some of these questions right. At the same time, I hope I learn something. So let's find out. One of the questions you ask is, if I could give you access to a quarter, five credit, single line video poker machine that has a 3.5% edge, how much would you pay for me to let you play it as long as you like? So... If you gave me that question, the first thing I would ask you is, are you telling us what the variance of the game is?
So that, you know, that's part of what the trick is, right? It's not so much a trick. It's the idea is that there are a lot of things that you have to consider when you gamble, when you try to gamble profitably, and that it's not just all about the expected value of a play. There's actually a lot that you have to factor in with, and most notably risk management. So this is kind of an example of this. That's the correct answer, is that, you know, you can't really answer this question right away. I mean, it's sort of phrased in kind of a vague way, but I have a game in mind for this, and it's definitely one that I'm happy to say I would not pay any money to be in this room, nor would I play it if it were available to me freely. So say the proprietor of this gambling establishment who had this one machine was named Bill Gates. And he decided to put in a machine that basically has it's a little over 103.5%, and it's a quarter five play machine, which means that, you know, your expected value playing this machine is about $44 an hour if you play reasonably quickly, if you play, say, 1,000 hands an hour. And what this machine is, it basically pays nothing unless you are dealt aces with a kicker, keep one of those aces, and draw a royal flush. And if you happen to do that, it pays $50 billion. So now the true odds of this happening are like a little over 38 billion to one. And it pays $50 billion. It costs you a buck and a quarter to play it. So it actually comes in at 103.5%. The variance on this game is almost $65 billion. And there's a concept I guess I didn't really introduce yet, which is the Kelly criterion. We can kind of get into that a little bit later, but basically, if you were doing a full Kelly bet, you would have to have a bankroll of more than $2 trillion for this game to be actually playable. The Royal Flush cycle is about 440 years of continuous play. So your full expectation about from sitting down at this game is that you're just going to lose as much money as you want to put into it. And that's about it. There is a tiny, tiny chance of becoming fabulously wealthy, but it's really not a realistic proposition for anybody to play. And again, this is to emphasize how important it is to manage risk in gambling. A lot of blackjack players talk about the Kelly criterion. I don't know that video poker players do as much. They probably should, though, because it does actually apply to any sort of risky venture. In fact, Ed Thorpe, who wrote one of the original textbooks about blackjack called Beat the Dealer. I read that book when I was 12, and this is one of the reasons I kind of got into gambling. He went on to apply this principle not just to blackjack, but then much more importantly to his hedge fund, and through principles about this sort of risk management, managed to grow fairly optimally. I think you guys definitely know. know him firsthand, and it certainly worked very well for him. So it really does. It's good about any sort of risky venture.
Now you mentioned that video poker players don't really talk about it, but how is that possible? I mean, they must talk about what size bankroll you need in order to play dollar or $5 or whatever it is they play, right?
Well, that's true. The Kelly criterion it mostly assumes that you have a continuous spread of the amount that you can bet. And so you can sort of scale up smoothly with wins and scale down smoothly with losses. When video poker players talk about like having a number of royal flushes sort of in the back pocket, and of course it depends on the amount of cashback, the amount of edge that you're playing with, basically – the rule of thumb is it's the edge divided by the variance of the game. And you can look these things up in tables if you don't have them. I know if you go to Wizard of Odds site, for instance, you can look up a lot of expected values and variances of different games. And then, when you plug it into that equation, it tells you what proportion of your bankroll you can risk at any given time without violating this. And there's a lot of good mathematical reason behind this. In fact, again, this comes up a lot in portfolio theory. How much money should you risk on a certain proposition? It is really based on optimizing your portfolio growth. So I have an example of this. So the best way that I can think of to explain this is, say you had a stock that is with the flip of a coin, basically, is either going to double in price or it's going to lose 2/3 of its value. So basically, if you have a stock worth $100, tomorrow it's going to be worth either $200 or it's going to be worth $33, and those are equally likely. Well, if you invest all of your money in this stock, your expected value is 1/6 every period you go through. You're going to multiply your money on average by 1/6. But the problem is that the typical result and the average result diverge very quickly because you are taking a lot of risk. So The one way to look at it is, say you had an up move. Sorry, say you started with $100 and you had an up move that takes you to $200, and then you had a down move where you lose 2/3 of that, which is like $66. Similarly, if you had the down move first, you'd start with 100, go down to 33, and then you'd double it the next day to 66. Well, half of the time, your amount is going from 100 to 66. A quarter of the time it's going down to something small, and then a quarter of the time it's going up to something large. Well, as you keep flipping this coin over and over again, your typical result is going to converge somewhere where you're just basically steadily losing money until you go broke, even though on average, meaning you have very, very small likelihood of getting a whole lot of money, those get more and more remote, those kind of chances. So what Kelly tells you to do is to bet a proportion of bankroll which is, you know, for small amounts of edge, it's proportional to the edge divided by the variance. In this particular example, if you bet, say, a quarter of your bankroll and readjusted it every time, you would enjoy a very healthy growth rate without having to worry about these, you know, this trending towards zero thing.
There's another factor having to do with money preferences not being linear. Now, I can't say for sure from personal experience, but I'm confident that the difference between $49 billion and $50 billion is a lot less than having the difference between $0 and $1 billion. So,
yes. And that dovetails nicely with this because it's, you know, there were economists that have come up with what they call utility theory. And so the idea is that doubling your money feels as good as losing half your money feels bad. So it's not like winning $1,000 compares to losing $1,000. Losing $1,000 is worse than winning $1,000 is good, if that makes any sense. And if you apply this logarithmically, you get Kelly out of it. It's a very convenient way of looking at it.
So you're saying that winning 1,000 is the equivalent of losing 500? I mean, the amount of
it depends on where you start, right? It's if I owned $1,000, then winning 1,000 would be the same as losing 500. If my net worth
sort of I don't know what happiness quotient or something.
Yeah, it's a convenient way when economists will model people's sort of risk averse behavior, it conveniently models that. Now, there's a lot of exceptions to this, of course, and it's not, you know, people don't always fit into the same bin because there are other effects that happen too. Like people still enjoy buying lottery tickets. And you know, if you take very small amounts of money, spending a dollar on the lottery is not going to change anybody's life appreciably at all. But the dream of the lottery, you know, might be worth the dollar.
Would you rather buy the lottery ticket or take the $1.25 spin on the $50 billion yes, video poker machine?
Very similar ideas.
Well, I don't know. It was a quarter five play. Maybe it was
quarter single play, five coin. Yeah.
Ah, okay, good. So I heard five play. Maybe it was five coins.
But even though you had positive EV on the video poker, you know, you could buy the lottery ticket and hold it for 3 or 4 days before the drawing. So you have 3 or 4 days of sort of fantasy, you know, for your dollar as opposed to, you know, 10 seconds on the video poker hand.
Right. And yes, if you buy the lottery ticket with yesterday's winning numbers, you can tape the lottery and then leave your friend with the ticket to check it and play the tape for him.
Yeah. That's got to be worth more than a buck and a quarter.
That's
the only use I've gotten out of the lottery.
All right, let's go on to a different subject. Now, you have a casino offering a $100 bonus for $10,000 coin in. So that's 1%. Now you have a choice between playing two machines, one single line, full pay deuces, that's 100.76% for buck and a quarter a spin, or $5 9-6 jacks or better, which is 99.54 at $25 a spin. Which machine is correct to play? Now, I've been doing this kind of problem for a long time. I'm pretty confident that I know the basic answer to it, but there's a lot of parameters to it that I hope you'll discuss some of those too. So go ahead, Max.
So what would you do?
What would I do?
Yes.
Okay, now strictly...
I should answer first because I'm not a video poker player.
Go ahead.
I would definitely play the $5 9-6 jacks.
Okay, why?
Because it's over in four spins, and time is money, and
it's 10,000 coin in.
So it's 400 spins.
Oh, it's 10,000 coin in. I'm sorry. Yeah, 10,000 coin in.
So assume it's a half hour for the $5 machine, but you're giving up a 0.5% round numbers, and it's 9 hours for the – or 10 hours for the quarter machine – but you have a 0.75% advantage.
Yeah. So, wow. First of all, I don't think I would play this at all. yeah, I would not play this.
Oh, I would. I would. Yeah, you would. If you're playing, assuming you can get done in a half hour.
Oh, yeah, half hour for $50. Yeah, I guess I would play that. Yeah, I would do the half hour for $50 as opposed to the how many hours for the $100?
10 hours.
10 hours. Yeah, that's not even close. I mean, yeah, my time is worth a lot more than $10 an hour.
Yeah, well, it's actually, but it's $176. So it's still $17 an hour versus $100 an hour. So that's one of the factors. But there's another factor is, can you do this over and over again, or is this a one-time shot? And if it's a one-time shot, then do you have something else to do with those 9 hours that makes up for the $125 that you're giving up by playing the lesser machine? Now, Richard, you think you do. I suspect you're right. But it's not a guarantee that you would. Another factor would be, well, the Kelly criteria you talked about earlier. There are some people who could not afford to play $25 a hand for 400 hands. And so they're better to grind it out. So what else are we leaving out, Max?
So there's not a lot that you're leaving out. And the purpose of that question really is to say that, you know, which machine is correct to play is probably not a fair question. You could actually answer that legitimately with either answer and be correct. Again, it depends on what sort of parameters and what else you're doing with your time. You know, the three of us have probably had these kind of like marathon gambling experiences for 10 hours at a time. And, you know, it makes you kind of dizzy playing 10 hours of quarter full pay deuces. And, you know, not to mention that it's not particularly exciting if you're used to gambling for more. You know, the best thing that can happen to you is winning $1,000, and that's not even a tax form. But, you know, that said, if you're trying, depending on what you're trying to maximize, it really matters how you approach it. I mean, you're either making $176 on the promotion or you're making $54 on the promotion. So, you know, you have to sort of decide that, and it's important to take into account, I guess, what your future prospects are when you're undertaking something. I specifically phrased it as a specific $100 bonus for 10,000 coin in. There are bonuses that are like that where you have a limited amount to do that, and you really have to decide if it's worth your day to sit there and try to maximize it, or, you know, spend a half hour this and perhaps the rest of the day doing something else that's enjoyable, or even finding another gambling opportunity. But basically, both answers are definitely correct.
Okay, so now I'd like to add a third parameter to the third choice on this problem. Let's say that this particular game is at an internet casino, and you have to deposit $125 to play this, at least $125 to play this game. And if you play the 10,000 coin in, you know, you get the $100 bonus. Or if you lose your $125, you get the bonus. And they offer a third game, which is a $25 6-5 bonus poker as a third option to play.
Yeah, it can actually get really bad before you wouldn't pick that third kind of game. When you have these sorts of things where the outcome is dependent on the path that you get to it. It often, and loss rebates are a perfect example of this. The variance of the game way outweighs the expected value of the game itself. In order to maximize the expectation of the promotion, you generally want as much risk as possible. And the trade-off there is very much favors the risk. So in that sense, I would play the 6-5, you know, game, or maybe even the slot machine if that were the only thing that were there. Even at 80%, I would think that would actually have a higher value than doing it the other way, because every now and then you'll hit something, and that's
right.
That's
right.
Really what you're trying to increase your variance on. You're not really playing for the $100 rebate. You're playing to hit something.
Well, and you're playing to not have to give up the $10,000 worth of action.
Right.
Which at full pay deuces, I guess, isn't really that big a burden. But well, it is in terms of time, but you're not giving up EV.
Well, that's also another – I mean, there was a promotion some time ago at the Revel in Atlantic City where they let you, you know, ostensibly have a rebate for $100,000 of loss, which they would give to you over time. And I mean, I'm sure there are listeners of yours that have participated in this. I personally didn't. I thought that the counterparty risk was too high, like the risk of just getting hosed on this.
I felt the same way.
But if I were to do it, I would have just sat down at the most expensive slot machine that they had in the place. I wouldn't even glance at the video poker and just bang away at it. Even if I played it for slightly lower edge from a mathematical standpoint, it's a much higher edge to be seen as a slot player trying to redeem a massively good promotion than a video poker player, I would think.
Yeah.
It turned out there wasn't any video poker to play. It was all the machines higher than $5, I think, were removed. And it's hard to lose $100,000 playing $5 video poker. So... Let's move on to a different subject. There's this great progressive where progressives is the royal flush goes higher and higher, but it's a long shot to hit it. And usually once you get a seat on these machines, you stay there or hand it off to a partner until you're done, until it's hit by somebody. Hopefully you, but somebody. So the question Max asks is, you can get a seat, but you only have an hour to play before your wife says, we're going to dinner with my mother, and you have to come. So you only have an hour. Is it worth it to sit down, even though you're probably not going to hit the royal within that hour? Is that a reasonable phrasing of the question?
That's a reasonable phrasing of the question. I guess maybe if you throw in the fact that you can't necessarily call a friend to take over or make a deal or, you know, that sort of thing. This is sort of a, you know, you're wandering in to, you know, you have an hour before dinner, you go into the casino you're eating at, and you happen to pass by one of those must hit by progressives, and you've seen these before. And, you know that sitting there is good, but you also know that, you know, on average, it might take 2 or 3 hours to hit that, and you just don't have that time. Is it still right to sit down?
Of course. EV is EV. So, yeah, I would have no qualms about playing it for an hour and then just getting up and leaving. I mean, right? At the end of our life, we're going to basically earn our EV. So I will get credit for having played that hour. At least that's the way I look at it.
I generally agree. Plus, there's a factor that maybe Max said we can't count, but sometimes you can sell your seat. And there are times that I've passed those progressives, and I would have given somebody $100 to be able to sit down and play. And so had somebody at that point said, you know, I'm going to play here for another 6 hours, but if you gave me $80, I'd just go do something else. Well, I would have paid. So, but you can't sell it unless you got it. So, so that's an additional factor, but Max may consider that cheating.
Yeah, no, I don't consider it cheating. It's just, it's just easier to focus on the problem if it's,
it changes the problem a bit. Variables. Yeah.
Still, I agree with both of you, and I think it's, people have trouble with this concept sometimes because it is so painful to get up from something like this after you've failed that I think sometimes it can kind of cloud your judgment. I know that the social effect of this works the other way too. I had a situation that was similar to this. Basically, I was just walking through a casino. The machine in question was a Lord of the Rings themed slot machine. And I knew from looking at this before that there was some symbol that you could hit, which would let you pick from among 20 items one of which contained the progressive. And if you failed to hit it, the next person got to pick from 19, et cetera, et cetera. So this game is playable around three or four. I don't remember the exact math in there, but something like when it's down to, you know, three or four choices, it's good to play. Well, there was a gentleman playing, and I'd never seen this in practice before, but he was playing a machine and it was a 1-to-1. So I look over and I'm thinking to myself, there's no chance that he's going to give this up. And then I spied his lady friend who was sitting next to him and sort of had a look on her face. And I thought, maybe I should sit around here a little bit because she's now changing the expected value of the entire proposition, right, for him. And at some point, it's going to be better for him to leave than to stay. And I just had to, you know, stick around. And sure enough, it only took about a minute. And the guy finally, they'd started arguing. And, you know, I'm sure he made it worse for himself. But she got him to stand up and go. And I sat down. And I think it took me about 4 minutes to hit the $500 progressive or something. which I feel really bad for the guy. But, you know, sometimes you have to do these things. I have had to leave progressives that I wanted to go because I've done the math on that department. Sometimes it's not worth the $500.
I have a friend who's basically a vampire who never sleeps, and I went out with him one time, and we played all of day shift, and you know, grabbed a slice of pizza, and then played all of swing shift, and after 16 hours, he was like, you know, there's a really good game on graveyard, and you know, it was a game that, you know, might have been worth 12% edge, you know, but I wanted to sleep, you know. I mean, my feeling is there are always edges out there to be had, you know what I mean? So, so I would have no problem at all if I'm willing to walk away from a 12% game where you can bet a lot more than, you know, whatever the slot machine. You know, I would have no qualms about playing the progressive for an hour and getting up and, you know, leaving it.
Going back to Max's situation where this guy's girlfriend caused it to change, were I in that situation and able to sit down after the guy gave up angrily, I would wait. I would take time putting money into the machine and putting my card into the machine and wait until he is out of the area. If I hit it after two spins, I might get hurt.
Yeah, I seem to recall I played that one correctly too. I wouldn't do that to the guy.
You got to have both. Not
actually, if it was bigger than $500, it's the girl that might have gotten hurt if you, you know, if you hit it right after he gets up.
In the interest of everybody's health and safety. Yeah, something with the player card.
All right, let's move on to something else. The question Max asked is, can it ever be correct to make a suboptimal draw in video poker where presumably suboptimal is being defined strictly in terms of EV. So
yes, if you took the video poker machine, entered it into the strategy calculator, is it ever right to do something other than what that says?
And for me, the answer is absolutely yes. It could depend on tax considerations. W2Gs are pretty much a non-factor for me. As you know, I get plenty of them. I can deal with them. Having an extra W2G is no problem. But were I playing in Mississippi and they're taking 3% off the top of the W2G and it's totally non-refundable, that could change things. Other players who don't get as many W2Gs as a pro does, the first several $1,000 of W2Gs is really a burden to get. There are definitely tax implications to that. So that would be one of the issues. Another could be tipping, where if I'm going to be tipping 10% on a jackpot and going having the chance for the jackpot is only worth a little bit more than not having the jackpot, it could be right to go for the second best play.
And just time, the time it takes for the W2G, if there's a, you know, if there's a time factor involved.
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be a W2G. Back when we had quarter coin droppers, which is when I started playing in the 90s, like on full pay deuces, on a hand such as deuce, 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 4-4, it is really a close play, really close, as to whether you hold all five cards for five of a kind, or you throw the two fours away and just hold deuce, deuce, deuce. Well, what happens is if you hit that fourth deuce, which happens between 4% and 5% of the time, then the coin starts, machine starts dropping 1,000 coins into the tray. And it's only going to hit 400 of them before they have to refill the machine. And that can take a while. So you're giving up a few pennies by holding all five cards there. But in terms of any kind of time wasted, that could be a factor. There's another factor on keeping your welcome. Sometimes you get enough W2Gs and a casino manager has decided this is a problem and the best way to put a stop to it is to invite this person not to come back anymore. So that can be a factor. So those are the ones off the top of my head. Are there other factors we're missing, Max?
So I came up with kind of a funny scenario. So these are all very legitimate factors. You could argue, I suppose, that the tax considerations and things should actually be part of the math anyway. So let me just give you the example, and then I'll give you a direct question about it. So let's just say I came to Vegas and participated in a $100,000 winner take all Keno tournament, which I don't know if such things exist, but that'd be funny if it did. And I won the thing. So now I have $100,000 in cash, and I go to take my flight home from Vegas, and something bad happens with the plane, and the plane has to make a crash landing in the middle of the desert, and I'm the only survivor, which is unfortunate. But I do have my $100,000 intact. I start wandering through the desert, and I come upon a video poker machine. So... Yeah, I've seen this.
This is really likely.
So I have this video poker machine here, and I look at the video poker machine pretty closely. And the first thing I notice is that there's a skeleton nearby who's kind of like clutching a player's card. And I look at the machine itself, and it's a progressive machine. And that the Royal Flush is currently $1 million progressive. And there's a secondary progressive on the straight flush, which is $1,000. And this is a quarter, 9-6 jacks or better video poker machine, five coins, whatever. So obviously, you know, this person, you know, perished trying to hit this $1 million. And I think, you know, I'm here. There's, you know, say for, you know, I don't have any health considerations or whatever, like there's, you know, supplies in the plane and I can last indefinitely. And my money is, you know, enough to hold out. And I sit down and I start putting the money in. So remember, 9-6 jacks or better machine with $1,000 for the straight flush, which is, you know, normally is
$6,250.
Right. And $1 million for the Royal Flush, which is normally $1,000. And I play, and my first hand is the King, Queen, Jack, 10, 9 of hearts. So now, what cards do I hold? So let me say right off the bat that if you have a quarter video poker machine that pays $1 million for a royal, there's very little outside of trying for royals that you ever want to do. I don't even know if there is anything outside of a royal that you want to try to do. You might throw away 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of hearts, for instance, to try for a royal. I don't know if it's that severe, but it's a lot, put it that way. So what do you do?
But the straight flush pays $1,000? You're dealt a straight flush, and the question is...
Straight flush pays. Yeah, and they're both progressive amounts. And say you just have seen these types of machines before, and you know that they're going to reset to something normal after you hit it.
Yeah, I would take off the straight flush jackpot, I guess.
I would go for the Royal. The EV on the Royal is considerably higher than $1,000. And you're going to hit that straight flush anyway. So yeah. I would go for the Royal.
Okay. Now, this, granted, is a pretty fantastical situation, but you also remember...
Oh, it happened to me just last week.
Right. Yeah, right. You also remember, though, that if you get this $1 million royal, that's going to trigger a W-2G. And I don't care where in the desert you're playing, the government will find a way to get you this paperwork. So what you assume is going to happen if I hit this royal flush is that somebody is going to alert the jackpot slot route company, and they're going to send out the jackpot van. And this person's going to notice you in the middle of the desert, and after paying you your $1 million plus whatever credits you have in the machine, is going to rescue you back to civilization. Does that change your answer? Meaning that you're
going to... Yeah, well, it wouldn't change Bob's because he's already going for the royal. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I guess I would go for the royal.
Well, it's not so much about the rescue itself. Assume the rescue is going to happen eventually. I guess the maybe this is a little too contrived, but the point that I'm trying to get at is that if you have this situation, even though it's overwhelmingly plus EV to go for the royal, I do agree with Bob in this respect. If that ends the promotion, then it's not correct to do that, because even if the royal paid nothing, the straight flush paying $1,000 puts the game well over 100%. And if you have enough money to sit there and play, and you know you're eventually going to be rescued, you know, you're eventually going to hit this royal. It might take you a little while. You know, again, the circumstances are a little odd. The whole point is that if the triggering event of the royal ends the opportunity for you, that's something to take into account. And this is relevant for one of the later problems that is actually a real life example. And not this contrived one.
Well, let's go to that one. Let's go to that one, because maybe that will bring more light to this.
So here is the actual problem that happened. So there was and in fact, Bob wrote a column on this several months ago. What's funny, though, is that the way that Bob – well, I'll tell you a little bit about the promotion. So there was a casino in town here in Vegas that had a promotion where if you followed certain restrictions, if you hit one royal, you were paid as normal. And then if you hit a royal a second time, you were paid a double amount on the royal. And it came in the form of free play or something, but I don't want to complicate it too much from what the actual promotion was. And then you were not eligible to do this again for that week. So the question really was, you know, what is the right strategy to do such a thing? Well, when Bob wrote a column about this, he said, if you have this sort of game and it repeats, basically, if you're allowed to just keep playing this and every other royal is doubled, then the correct strategy is to take, you know, the 4,000 royal that you would get for the single and the 8,000 royal that you get on the double and average them together and play as though it were a 6,000 coin royal continuously. And that would actually maximize your expected value for this repeated promotion. So the way that the column is written, I fully agree with it, right? And I think you actually took steps to say this was not the promotion that occurred in real life. This is just something I'm going to bring out as a general principle. And it is kind of counterintuitive if you think about it, because you would think that your strategy would change depending on whether you're in the cheap royal or the expensive royal cycle. But if you look at it as a promotion where you're getting, you know, two royals at once, then it becomes clear that it really doesn't, that you're going to be much better off using sort of a blended strategy. I've discussed this with many very good gamblers and very good mathematicians. And what's funny is that every single person seems to have a slightly different answer about this. As far as in the actual promotion that was done, which is basically you get to do this one time, what is the right way to play it? So here's the first example. So here's the first hint, I want to see whether this sheds some light on it. So does the amount of cash back offered change your strategy with this?
Well, it cash back is so minimal as to assuming, I don't know, if we're talking a dollar royal, for $4,000, and this particular club is probably, for most players, it was 0.3%, if you've played enough. I would not think the cashback would have mattered. Obviously, it does, or you wouldn't have brought it up. But to me, the cashback doesn't change my strategy.
Right, and one of the gentlemen I was discussing this was kind enough to put together a fairly extensive analysis of the different strategies you could use in this, with the expected values of each type of play. And cashback was definitely not a consideration in any of those. And he came to the conclusion that the 6,000 coin strategy on both was correct, even for this thing. Now, I want to bring you back to this desert island example or whatever that I went over. If the cashback, say, were 100%, like it was a loss rebate, not even a loss rebate, a play rebate. So basically you were given every time you spent $1.25 on your machine, you were given $1.25 in cashback. Would that change the strategy? Well, for most gamblers, this would be too good of a promotion to kill. So the right play for this machine would actually be to, if it were possible, even throw away a dealt royal. I know the machine locks up when that happens, but the value of the doubled royal is swamped by the expected value of playing a game with this much cash back. Because if the promotion ends, then you're not eligible for it anymore. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And then the other – well, so this bringing this over into kind of blackjack territory, when you count cards, you know, if you have a counting strategy and you're trying to count cards, the purpose of that is not to see what's been already played. It's to see what's yet to be played. Card counting is just a way to keep track of what is about to be played. What the order of the cards came out or anything else that happened in the past is ancient history. It doesn't really matter what happened to get you to the point that you are. You're basically in a certain game state and you want to play it correctly. So nothing that happened in the past can ever influence what happens in the future. Does that make sense?
And actually, this comes up all the time for table games players, and so many of them screw it up because the game is so valuable. I mean, there are games out there that are so valuable that you just don't want to do anything that would make the game end, and yet there are these players who want to squeeze every nickel out of things, and they do things that end up getting them barred, which ends up costing them so much money, the amount of money they cost themselves compared to what little money they saved by, you know, not playing through the relief dealer or you know, things like that. I mean, there are just these things they could do that would cost them so little to disguise what they're doing, and then they end up costing themselves the whole opportunity because they want to save that extra, you know, $7. So, yeah, this comes right up a lot, yeah, for table game players.
Yes, and you know, like, for instance, you know, hitting a hard 17 against a dealer's ace is correct sometimes, right?
Yep.
But I would say that it's never correct, right? Unless you're...
Yeah. Yeah. Or it's, you know, it's like these guys who see a dealer's hole card the first time in their life and the dealer has 20, so they hit a hard 19, you know? It's just, like, ludicrous. But...
Yes. So that's one thing that is, you know, a bit different about this. Obviously, the amount of cashback does or can potentially affect your strategy, but it's more about the preservation of the game itself. Now, even with that said, it still seems very convincing when you look at the spreadsheet of numbers and you see, okay, playing 6,000 coin royal strategy earns this much amount of time and takes on average, or this much amount of money and takes on average this amount of time, and so you get a dollar per hour figure. that is maximized when you do this, as opposed to some sort of other strategy that involves changing after you get a royal. The problem is, and this is the thing that really threw me for a loop when I started looking about this, is that you can't compare the dollars per hour in a game that ends with a game that goes on in perpetuity, just because of this little end effect that happens, where basically you're going to get that second royal, and then you have to figure out what else to do with your time. In one case, if you have nothing better to do with your time, the way you optimize it is not by playing a 6,000 coin royal strategy. It's actually by playing something called the min cost royal strategy, which is treating the royal at something like 4,800, or I forget the exact amount, but it's basically, you know, the quickest way to get to a royal flush while not paying off too much to the other hands. It's a point at which you optimize this. And that gives you the highest total amount of money won for the promotion, even though it takes longer to do. So going back to the problem where people either want to play the $5 game or play the quarter better game, it depends on what else you want to do with your time. Now, there's something that goes a bit even further than that, that once you've hit the first royal, you're now playing a different game than you used to be playing. When you're looking ahead and you're saying, I have to hit two royals to get this bonus, that's all the information that you have. After you've hit the first royal, though, your information about playing the game changes, because now you only have to get one royal. It's not a parlay of events. So the best way to explain what happens there is the hint that if you and I were to sit down basically to play this promotion, and we both hit a royal on our first hand, you know, hit our first royal sitting next to each other. Now we're both in a situation where we play for the second royal, which is going to be doubled. If you follow along and do the 6,000 coin strategy, and I look at it and do the 8,000 coin strategy, I'm actually going to do better, because I'm sitting basically at a game for the first time with an 8,000 coin royal. Nothing that's happened in the past affects this. The reason it looks like it averages a higher dollar figure per hour is that the math that you've done assumes that you've played an entire royal cycle to hit your first royal. And so extending the game a little extra on the second royal, because you're playing a better game, actually boosts the average of that previous play. But if you're very lucky to hit the royal on your first hand, any play that you do subsequently is actually lowering that average. So it's not the proper way to look at it to solve the problem. And I guess the closest thing I can think of is the analysis of Ultimate X, where your hand that you play now affects the next hand. So you have to take into account all of the future activities that occur as a result of playing this. Is this at all clear? A weird concept. So if you're sitting there and you want to make the right decision to do that, you actually want to take into account all the information that you have currently. Now, the reason the 6,000 coin royal blended strategy works, if you can repeat the game, works on the same principle, because now you can look at it. If you sit down and play the double royal first, then upon hitting it, your royal's going to have in value. So you actually have a future event to average into your current event. Just like Ultimate X, if I know that my next hand is going to be the last one that I play there, I'm going to play it with 5 coins, not 10.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
Because that's going to end the promotion. Even though I know it's higher value to play 10 coins, the correct play on that, because of the edge effect of I'm about to get up, is to play 5 coins. So
There's another factor that hasn't been considered. I don't know if that would change the problem. Is at the promotion at the casino, it ended at midnight Saturday night. And whether you've hit that second promotion or not, a second royal or not, if you hit it after midnight Saturday night, you're just going to get paid 4,000 coins.
Yeah.
So how does that make it a totally different problem?
Or so that also, Go ahead.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're not considering that type of ending thing at all.
Right. I'm assuming that you're going to eventually be allowed to complete the promotion. So again, it's not the exact thing that happened in the casino.
Well, but it at that point, doesn't it sort of go back to would you play the must hit by when you know that you have to get up in an hour? It's really kind of that same problem, isn't it?
Yes. And actually, if you have a limited time to get the Royal, as you approach that time, your strategy probably should change. And at some point, it's going to be at some point you're going to be forced to leave the machine Royal or no. The conclusion that I have about this, because I've already presented that, you know, some people it's right to play the MCR strategy to the min cost Royal strategy. For some people it's right to play the 8,000 coin strategy, and it really depends on what you plan to do afterward. And so there is actually no true mathematical answer, just like there's no answer to whether it's right to play the $5 game or the quarter game. It depends on what other opportunity you have. If you're going to just sit around and twiddle your thumbs, then you want to play the min cost Royal and spread it out, assuming you have the time to finish that. If you have another opportunity that's comparable to the one that you have, then you probably should play a more accelerated, you know, maybe an 8,000 coin Royal strategy, for instance, to get up and go be able to do that. My point, though, is the fact that the first Royal was worth 4,000 doesn't change at all what you're supposed to be doing now. That's not a factor in the equation, even though it seems like it. To get to the 6,000 number, you have to average both of those. But since that event already happened, it can't possibly affect what you're doing in the future. So that's, yeah. it really comes down to like pennies. I mean, this is really just kind of like a funny discussion to have. This is not, there's not a whole lot of practical value in that. You know, I guess something that does have practical value that's similar to it is what, if you're playing a video poker tournament, your strategy for playing actually changes as the tournament progresses. If you haven't hit your aces with a kicker or your royal flush or whatever it is that you're playing for, depending on the size of the tournament, you're going to play more and more aggressively for something like that, just because, you know, fifth through last place pays the same, for instance.
Right.
You're going to get it or you don't.
All right. So we got some more questions to ask Max Coins. I'm going to take a few minutes to do some commercials, but we're not done with Max. So, Max, hold on, please.
Will do.
South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. Big promotion this month is called the $600,000 April Showers Giveaway. Every night, April 1st to April 30th at 8:15 p.m., one person's name will be called for $10,000 cash, which must be claimed in 4 minutes or the prize reverts to $500 in free play, and another name is called. Eventually, they'll have one $10,000 cash winner and 20 $500 free play winners. You do not have to physically show ID to claim the $500 free play. You simply play it off within 7 days or it evaporates. There's a maximum of 10,000 tickets to be earned each day between 9 p.m. the night before the drawing and 8 p.m. the night of the drawing. Video poker players earn one ticket per dollar coin in. Slot players earn 3 tickets per dollar coin in. The virtual barrel is emptied after each drawing. Video poker classes are now on semester break. My current best guess is that the next semester will begin Wednesday, August 10th. At the Palms, between now and the end of April, they'll have drawings every Friday and Saturday night at 7:15. Must be present to win. 5 winners. With top prize of $2,500, total prize $5,000. Plus, each one of those 5 people gets a chance to win $1 million in the $1 million match game. It's 16,000 to 1 against you, but you do get a shot at it. PFP, play for prizes. Until Friday, April 15th, you earn Walgreens gift cards. Cards are redeemed at a rate of 0.2%. Up to 190 per day. You keep the points. For the 2 weeks following, you can earn gift cards to Kohl's at the same rate. Kohl's is K-O-H-L apostrophe S. In April, every Sunday and two Wednesdays, the 13th and the 27th, earn you double points. The Wednesday multipliers also earn you the PFP awards, the gift cards. The Sunday multipliers do not. There is no maximum on the number of double points you can earn. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games, including Quick Quads and a few of the others. Game of the week is Ultimate X. Ultimate X is 10 coins per line game, where players earn bonuses on this hand, which are redeemable next hand. Correct strategy takes into consideration both the amount of your win on this hand and the multiplier you're going to win on the next hand. The best place for strategies for several of the pay schedules is the wizardofodds.com. Some, but not all, of the strategies are included there. There are member rewards for playing on the site. In April, the site is featuring Quick Quads Video Poker, and play on that game earns you twice the membership points that you would normally get. Before we get back to Max Coins, there was a bit of news. The IRS was planning, or at least looking into, lowering the W2G threshold from $1,200 to $600. All players were against it. Most casinos were against it. And the IRS has finally said, enough, we're giving up on this. So this is good news for players, good news for casinos. I don't know how they're going to solve whatever problem they think exists, but this is not the solution they have in mind. Okay, we're talking to Max Coins. One of the questions that, let's say we were playing craps instead of video poker, and there were two prop bets, like maybe rolling both a six and rolling an eight before you rolled two sevens, and you barred the six and eight on the come out roll. How would you figure out how much that is worth? So Max, how did you go about that?
All right. So these are two different prop bets, and one of them, I'm not sure. Neither of these are original. I've not thought of these myself.
I was going to say, did these come from Scarny's Complete Guide to Gambling?
One of them I got from Darwin Ortiz's Gambling Scams. He has a section on prop bets. Yeah, I guess he discusses a lot.
I think he got this from Scarny.
But, oh, that could be. That could be. And I'm not actually not sure where I read the other one. But the reason that these, you know, that I highlighted these is because they're very counterintuitive to people who play a lot of craps, right? So if you have a sit, the first one is basically, you know, hey, you guys all know that the seven, of course, is the most likely roll. Six and eight are good points to have, but of course the seven is the one that beats it. So the prop that you offer to the
sucker,
the mark, right, is that I would like to say that I can roll a six and an eight before you can roll, or before the dice come up two sevens. So it's like, instead of having a six is the point and then you seven out, you basically have six and eight as the 2 points that you have to get before you roll seven twice. And it seems intuitive, I guess, that the since the sevens are more likely, that you have that situation occur more often. And the reason that's the wrong way of looking at it is because when you first roll one of or the other of six or eight, you have a much greater choice. So basically the union of six and eight compares very favorably with seven. So if there's six rolls that show up with a seven and there are five rolls for each of the six and eight, you now have 10 out of 16 rolls that actually matter, that will be one of the six or the eight. And then only six rolls actually bring you closer to the seven. So, to sevening out. So, if you break it down and basically look at all of the different game states and multiply out the probabilities, you actually find that almost 55% of the time, the six and eight will come first. So what makes this a good prop bet is that A, it's counterintuitive, and B, it's actually very close to even. It's the sort of thing where you will make money over time, but it's in a subtle enough way that, you know, that your opponent might just think that he was being unlucky, as opposed to just having the worst of it. The other prop is basically, this is the one from the Ortiz book, and that is about what happens if you bar the 6 and 8 on the come out roll. And so, you know, craps players can intuitively know that, you know, if you're the shooter betting the pass line, that 6 and 8 are your best points. But if you were to bar those, then obviously only points 4, 5, 9, or 10 could be rolled and made. So it looks like you're actually removing, you know, two of the good things that can happen for the shooter. But both the 6 and 8 are actually still negative propositions. They're less negative than the other ones, but it's enough when you bar those to actually put the favor in the shooter's favor. So a lot of craps players would want to fade this bet when it's actually incorrect to do that.
Right, makes sense.
That's definitely counterintuitive. All right, we've been talking to Max Coins. I'm happy that I got most of the video poker answers correct, and that I also learned something. I have never tired of learning new things on this game. So I thank you very much, Max, for joining us today. It was very educational for me, and hopefully for our listeners as well.
Thank you for having me.
Richard, where can we get our podcast?
Well, first of all, we welcome your questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. If you want the show delivered to you automatically every week, you can sign up at iTunes, YouTube, or Stitcher, or my site, richardmunchkin.com. And to get the archives of every show ever done, you can find those at bobdancer.com.
Very good. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Max. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.